Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Michael Connolly, who reads from and discusses his new Harry Bosch novel, The Overlook, published by Little Brown. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it is my pleasure to both welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. We are so very glad to welcome the fabulous and best-selling author Michael Connolly back to the Tattered Cover to discuss his latest and 19th book entitled The Overlook, the 13th book featuring the unforgettable character of Harry Bosch, who first appeared way back in 1992 with The Black Echo. The Overlook is unusual in this day and age in that it first appeared as a 12-part New York Times Magazine serial last fall, and prior to it being published in book form, Michael had the chance to tweak it and flesh it out, expanding it to the electrifying thriller that is now gracing our bookshelves. A former journalist who primarily specialized in the crime beat in South Florida, you can discover his crime writing in the book Crime Beat, A Decade of Covering Cops and Killers. He then, along with two other reporters, spent months interviewing survivors of a major airline crash, writing a magazine article which was later shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. Michael then went on to become a crime reporter for the LA Times, and 3 years later, he wrote his first novel to feature Harry Bosch. Michael Connolly has won every major crime fiction prize, including the Edgar Award, and has topped the bestseller list many, many times. We are so glad that he is here tonight. Please welcome Michael Connolly.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Sorry, I haven't been here in a couple of years, and so I'm sorry I'm late. I've been waiting at the other place for everybody to show up, but I got it right, so I'm glad I'm here. So I was going to talk about The Overlook, and I know it's been a couple of years since I've been here, but I know I've talked to you all before about the place for serendipity in this the mysterious world of writing. The mystical world of writing. I've had so many chance occurrences happen to me that led to me writing stories, writing whole books, where I wasn't expecting to get an idea. I've gone to a baseball game, sat next to a stranger, and left that game with an idea for a book. You know, that sort of things. I've had coffee with somebody, an old acquaintance, and left after a cup of coffee with an idea for a book. So I think part of the, I don't know if you'd call it a skill or the luck of writing, is to be aware and to kind of put yourself in a position to, you know, keep your ears open, your eyes open, and be ready for these type of things to kind of fall into your lap and recognize them when they happen. And a lot of what I do to get in that position is trade stories. And I'm not talking about the books I write, but I hear things. I travel a bit in a world of investigators, and they're all great storytellers, and I trade stories with them. And every now and then I get a story in return that I realize that I could spend a year with that. I could spend a year exploring that story, expanding it, making it my own, giving it to like a character like Harry Bosch or something like that. And that's really actually where The Overlook came from. And in a way, when I sit back and trace it, it really has a weird beginning. It begins with when I bought this watch. If I had not bought this watch, I might not have written this story. And I know that sounds weird, but this is how it happened. there's a patrol sergeant with the Los Angeles Police Department who I've known for a number of years and has helped me numerous times with my books. He at one point even wrote a glossary for me of LAPD slang that I have on my computer and I can refer to when I want to try to have a character sound realistic. I always look at my friend Bob McDonald's glossary. And he had a little side business for a number of years. He collected watches or collects watches, particularly military watches, and he started a website where he was buying and selling these things. And then it got a little bit bigger and more involved, and he ended up starting a company that actually made military watches, a very small scale He'd sell 300 or 400 watches a year. And like I said, he's helped me for a number of years of my books. And so I thought I'd attempt to even up the score and make it a little bit of a two-way street. And so I've bought a couple watches from him over time. And the last one I bought was this one, which he manufactured. And after I bought it and started wearing it, I noticed there was a little – the trefoil symbol, radiation warning symbol on the face of the watch, which sent me to my computer to send him an email, you know, saying, you know, what's with this radiation? Is this watch a danger? I mean, I make my living with my hands. Are they going to work in 10 years? And so he explained that this is a real military watch. When you buy it, it comes with I forget what it's called, but it covers the face so that the glow is not seen on a battlefield, that type of thing. But he said in this watch is a little glass, really tiny glass vial that has tritium in it, which is a radioactive material and which reacts with the paint on the numerals of on the face of the watch and makes them glow. And they really do pop. And at night, you know, if I have this watch on the bed table, I can see it from far away. If I make the mistake of wearing it to sleep and I move around and it's anywhere near my eyes, I can tell what time it is without opening my eyes. So it really works, this stuff. And therefore, you have the radiation symbol. And when I brought all this up with him, he said, let me tell you a funny story. And he said, here I am, selling a few hundred of these a year. And I'm a policeman, and this is my side job. And a couple of years ago, I got an email from someone in the Middle East saying they wanted to buy 5,000 of my watches, and give me the banking instructions for shipping the money. And he was, counting what kind of windfall that would be, 5,000 watches all at once. But before he got a chance to react to it, someone from Homeland Security called him and said, "Do not fill that order." And, since he's a cop, he was able to ask him, why and all this stuff. And they said it's because of the tritium. We don't want someone to have all that tritium. And my friend, the cop, just thought this was an unbelievable joke because we're talking about a little tiny vial. And he can just picture these terrorists like breaking open the little vials. I don't know if you remember about 10 years ago, there was even a Doonesbury cartoon where Zonker was scraping the glow stuff off of his watch because he wanted to make some kind of bomb. And it was so he looked at it that way as a joke. But anyway, that was the end of it, and he told me that story. And that's the coin of my realm, storytelling, trading stories. And so sometime later, several months, maybe a year later, I'm having lunch with a guy in Homeland Security, a Secret Service agent who I've met through other means and has also helped me with books. And I said, hey, here's a funny story. And I told him the story of the tiny vials of tritium. And that led him to tell me a story that became The Overlook. So that's how it works. And the story he told me was, he said, I doubt he said, I bet you that was a legitimate order, and I don't really think terrorists were trying to buy 5,000 watches and we're going to take them all apart. But he said that's kind of symbolic of our vigilance now, our vigilance close to paranoia, that they pick off stuff off the wires, they hear things, whatever they do, they're listening or whatever, and they react to it. And he said an example of that is this true story that in 1998 in Greensboro, North Carolina, there is a women's health clinic. It's a cancer clinic for treating cervical cancer. That's their specialty. And in the middle of the night, someone broke into that clinic. This is back in 1998, prior to 2001, obviously. And went into their lab and stole all their cesium. Now, cesium is also a radioactive material that has a wonderful application in treating certain forms of cancer. That's the good part of it. The bad part of it, in a large quantity, it can be quite dangerous. And it's also a very expensive material to get. And so in 1998, it was all 32 pieces. Each one was about the size of a pencil eraser, were stolen out of the safe in the lab of this place in Greensboro. And 9 years later, or however long it's been, they've never been found. But back in 1998, it was treated as a financial crime, that this stuff was stolen because it's valuable. And it's never been found, but it was assumed it was resold somewhere overseas to another lab. And he said, Now, imagine if that happened in 2007. Would it be treated as a financial crime? No. He said it would cause it would literally cause pandemonium among the ranks of Homeland Security and the full forces of our federal investigators that deal in terrorism and so forth would descend on Greensboro, and they would be all over this trying to find out who took this stuff, where is it, and what do they want to do with it. And he said that's an example of how our world has changed. And his sentence, that's an example of how our world has changed, was what sparked the story that became The Overlook. And, of course, it's not set in Greensboro. It's set in Los Angeles, and it's got Harry Bosch in it. But it's a story about how a small or seemingly routine, possibly mundane investigation blossoms into something very big. And to use the words of my friend, almost a federal pandemonium of agencies trying to find some missing cesium. The story begins with Harry Bosch being called in the middle of the night or right at midnight to go out to the Overlook on Mulholland Drive to take over an investigation of a homicide because the team that originally got the call is too busy with other cases, and Harry's free and open, and it's his turn to take on a case. And so Harry goes out there, and he finds out that the victim was a medical physicist who's a person who deals in these materials at the hospital in any community, and that he had access to pretty bad stuff if it is used in the wrong way or falls into the wrong hands. And as he's just beginning to put this together, and maybe the hair is rising a little bit on the back of his head and back of his neck, the Homeland Security people start showing up, and it suddenly blossoms into a major case that's flying well above the radar and moving very quickly, because if they find out that the man who was murdered did go and check out a large quantity of cesium, and it's now missing. And so that's what this book's all about. And I didn't give really anything away. This is all becomes clear in the first couple of chapters. And what it is I hope this is I don't want to stand up here being didactic about how we've all changed. That is certainly a theme of this book, but the main theme is entertainment and drama. And I think this is a pretty tight story that moves very quickly. In fact, the whole book takes place in 12 hours. And most of the investigations I've written about with Harry are very quick. You know, they're counted in days instead of weeks or months. But I think this is the quickest one I've ever written about. I mean, Harry actually does stop for one meal, but usually, but it's kind of begrudgingly, and there is a purpose actually for him to stop. So anyways, it's pretty fast moving. I'm a fan of the show 24. And I think that certainly influences this book. And the key thing to remember is that Harry gets done in 12 hours what it takes Jack Bauer 24 to do. So he's got him there. And so that's really what it's about. And I hope you, if you get a chance to read it, you'll enjoy it. If you read the early version that ran in the New York Times, this is pretty different. I mean, it's the framework is the same 12-hour thing, but it's expanded. I've added a lot of, I think, depth to Harry. It kind of is a story that moves forward and backwards at the same time. We're obviously moving forward through these 12 hours, but there's also some flashbacks to an earlier Harry, kind of filling in the character I've been writing about for 15 years. And so there's more of it there. So if you already did read it, then don't buy it, but borrow it from somebody, because I think you'll find a fuller story and a more rewarding story. The thing about the New York Times was when they came calling, I said, yeah, I'll do that, you know, without really thinking about it. And it was very difficult to do because it was a different way of writing. It's not the way I write normally. And in that thing, each segment had to be 3,000 words. So I was writing to fill a space as opposed to writing to move a story a step forward. When I write chapters for my books, I never look at the word count or the page count. I want each chapter to move the story forward a significant step. And I couldn't do that with the New York Times version. So it was a great treat, I guess you'd say, or for me to be able to take that story that had run there and rework it and write it the way I normally write it and present it as the story I would have liked to have presented in the New York Times. That's it, right? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming here tonight. I appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on May 30th, 2007.